that were offered and the recreational programs that were being offered in the park, our commission decided to start enforcing or to continue enforcing the park closing at midnight. And in order to do that, based on the federal mandate from Miami, our interpretation was that we needed to create a safe zone. Mm-hmm. We have an area that a city area that we have set aside, which we allow people who are homeless to use, and they can receive. You know, what we've done is to put up a shower, a tent as a canopy, a covering type thing. Mm-hmm. On a first come first serve basis, they were allowed to go there and stay there.
How many people are using this area?
We have 160 spaces. However, I think as many as 240 or upwards of that are using the facility on a regular daily basis.
And how large is the population of Fort Lauderdale?
160,000.
And how long has this camp been in existence?
Well, 4 years, 4 or 5 years.
Really? And is it has it been operating fairly successfully?
Well, it depends on how you define success. If you define success as being a magnet for attracting other homeless people, it's been successful. If you look at success as a means of rehabilitating the people and then get them qualified for rehabilitation into a mainstream society, it's not been successful.
So you would say that this camp has been has drawn other homeless people?
Yes.
Is there any stats on that you would kind of put forward that would clarify that?
No, because it's a safe zone, not a shelter per se. We don't have people registered to come in. You can come and go as you please. We don't have any stats on what the histories are, whether the people were homeless before, whether they're genuinely homeless, or they have somewhere and just choose to be there.
Now, are these places where people can park their vehicles? Are they places where people can just walk in? What's the situation?
It's actually just walk in.
Uh-huh. And what about folks who are sleeping in their vehicles? Do you have a law against that in Fort Lauderdale?
Yes, that is prohibited.
So what do those folks do? Do they sort of park their cars and walk in, or?
Well, those people, regardless of whether you have a car, a home, or whatever, we don't monitor that. If someone comes and walks in, they're not, we don't discriminate on them against them because they have a car.
How big an area is this place?
It's a parking lot which is probably about 2 acres or less.
And toilet facilities are there as well?
Yes.
And what about cooking facilities?
No.
And are folks allowed to cook their own food? Do they have access to electricity or?
No.
So it's actually simply sort of a place where people can sleep if they want, pretty
right,
much.
Right.
And how has the local media treated this?
Well, there are different perspectives. Some maybe from the business community, some from the civic community, some from the homeless activist community. Some actually is saying that it's the process of enabling the people who fall in that category. There's been a variety of spins on this ball.
Well, has the situation, would you feel, you seem to feel that it has drawn people. Did it have a much smaller number when you started, or has it essentially stayed about the same size, or what's that?
The number has definitely increased, yes.
You link this to changed economic conditions in Fort Lauderdale, or is it simply to something else?
I would definitely not link it to a change in the economic situation. What I'd do is to link it to increased knowledge and awareness that this safe zone is available. I mean, people come from as far as Cincinnati or New York coming down saying, well, they heard that, they essentially lost their jobs or whatever. They were heading to Florida and they heard about this safe zone, so they're coming here.
An average stay time that you, I know you don't have any real specific sense, but do you yourself have a general sense of people generally stay a couple months and move on, or you certainly have a few, I imagine, stay for the long period of time, but is that the rule or the exception?
I think that's probably the rule, because a lot of these people probably don't work, or if they work, it's probably, day laborers. A lot of these people may have mental, psychological problems. A lot of them may have alcohol problems or drug abuse. So there are a number of situations that cause the situation of homelessness. And I think over at the site, or in general, you find you know, a variety of issues become into play.
Horace, my name's Robert Norris. And you're with the commission on this issue, or?
No, I work in the city manager's office. I'm an administrative assistant.
And how does the city manager's office get involved? I mean, have you been providing services, I guess, porta potties and shower? Has that been your...
Well, no, the city manager, I'm not sure if you're familiar with our form of government, where you have the commission who is actually directs the policy, and the city manager who administers the day-to-day operation of... So he runs the city.
Uh-huh.
Part of running his city is the police and the parks and recs and the fire and all that stuff. I work in his office, and within that office, one of the things we did was to more or less take the lead in coordinating the services and facilities of the site, which would include probably the maintenance, the security, the on-site cleaning, you know, services from public services or public utilities in terms of providing the porta-johns and the various clean-outs, the dumpster, and all of those things.
Now, have you been like with the city for this period of time throughout this safe zone setup?
Yes, I have.
And has it changed, how do the police feel about it? Do they feel it increases their problems, it decreases their problems in terms of rounding up illegal campers? What's the situation?
Well, you know, we don't, our police don't target people who are homeless and make an effort to round them up. I think our police only address the homeless people if they're committing a violation of any of our laws.
Let me put it differently. I don't mean to put it in a negative light for you, but certainly there probably were a number of complaints about people sleeping in different areas of the city prior to the safe zone.
Right.
Have those complaints increased, decreased, or stayed the same as far as you know?
They may have shifted, where now you may have a concentration of those complaints coming from the area maybe closer to the safe zone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably because at some point after the capacity has been reached or after a point they no longer feel comfortable sleeping there, you know, they'll leave there and maybe just crash out of the building very close by or an area very close to there.
Mm-hmm. Is sleeping a criminal offense in Fort Lauderdale outside of the safe zones?
No, unless it's on private property, and people have filed trespass affidavits with the police department, which they'll post, and that serve as a warning saying that you know, trespasses will be prosecuted, that we have authorized the police department to do so.
But on public property, sleeping is not a crime?
That's correct.
And is that after the court decision, or was that the case before?
That was the case before.
So, what do police do if they find someone sleeping on the sidewalk? Do they have no way of moving that person if they want to, if they go to the safe zone or not?
That's correct.
So the safe zone actually is an additional protection for homeless people. It's not a way of saying, you were saying it's a way of closing the parks. Parks are prohibited. So there are some public spaces that are closed at night.
Correct. And for example, probably if in City Hall, which is open, and if it's closed at 7, for example, and somebody were in here or you were to ask them to leave, they refused to leave, you know, that's grounds for arresting them for trespassing, similar to the park.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody were sleeping on the sidewalk or on a bus bench on the sidewalk, that's a little different, where we had no grounds to ask them to move.
What's the racial composition of your city? Is it a mixed group down there in Fort Lauderdale?
Yes, it is a mix.
Mostly Spanish speaking,
mostly white Caucasians, and then probably maybe around 20% or up between 20 and 30% blacks. Then you have Hispanics also.
A lot of immigrants in Fort Lauderdale?
Yes.
And is that reflected in the encampment? I'm sorry, in the safe zone?
No, that's not.
mostly white males in the safe zone?
That's correct.
How about women and children? Are many of them show up there?
No, women who show up there, no children.
Are children not allowed there? Or?
Yes, correct. That's correct.
So what do children, what do homeless kids do in Fort Lauderdale?
Whenever a child is brought to the site, we immediately contact people like HRS, which is a human, HRS, human...
Human resources, something?
Yeah, health and... It's, they deal with child welfare and things like that, which they would intervene, probably look at whether the child is attending school, whether the environment is adequate for the child, whether the parent is able to care for the child. And I guess in instances like that, they immediately step in, and I don't know what efforts they make in terms of placement of the family and or the child individually.
What has been the attitude of homeless organizations, and I guess the ACLU is active in Fort Lauderdale as well?
Or, oh, yeah.
Toward this encampment and toward city policy toward the homeless. Are they critical of you? Are they supportive? Is there a mixed bag? What's
extremely critical. Very, very critical.
In spite of the safe zone?
That's correct.
And how would you describe their criticisms, and how would you respond to them? Or would you?
Well, the criticisms come in a number of forms. For example, one recent course of acrimony between us and them is they're individuals who choose to feed the homeless at the site, and that's perfectly and allowed by us. However, it's right next to an area that's owned by the city also, which we need to leave as a clear zone. And by starting to enforce that prohibition on that area, I think they see it as an attack on, you know, the feeding of the homeless.
So has there been a policy of feeding the homeless that was not previously interfered with, and now there's a change in that policy by the city, or?
Right. It's not really feeding the homeless. It's an issue of where people can park if they're coming to the camp. Uh-huh. You know, you talk about 30, 40 trucks being parked in a clear zone for a helipad, and that's not something that we want to encourage. Previously, we didn't enforce that. We started enforcing that. So issues like that are viewed negatively by the ACLU and by advocates of the homeless.
Is this because of the rise in the number of vehicles, or because of their choice of a different place to feed than previously, or?
No, because of the Federal Aviation Authority.
So the feds got annoyed with the feeding on the helipad, so to speak?
Not feeding in the helipad, with the...
Parking on the helipad.
The increased traffic activity in an area where, for aircraft safety, no one should be parked or walking.
So where exactly is this camp located in the feeding area near it? How would you describe that with respect to City Hall or downtown?
It's in the core of downtown. It's a block from City Hall. That's where the safe zone is, and that's where people regularly go to feed these individuals.
And what's the response been from the merchant community? Are they critical of City Hall from the other side for this situation, or when you're getting flack from the other direction?
We had complaints from them about the vagrancy, about the visibility of homeless within the community. I think they're sympathetic to opposition, very well knowing that there's really not a win-win situation. But that short of finding health care and medical care and case management and all of those things for maybe 250 people who are at that camp, and more globally, 5,000 or 6,000 homeless individuals who are said to be in Broward County.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if Miami has a similar safe zone?
Offhand, I do not know.
Do you know of any other place in Florida that has a safe zone similar to yours?
Orlando has, but it's a little bit different.
What are the differences?
It's a dormitory style with a cover. There were in the mornings they've got to wake up and I guess there's a check-in policy. It's more of a shelter as opposed to a safe zone.
That's sort of more social workers running around, that sort of thing.
Well, possibly some of that, but
case managed.
They're required to probably be up and about doing something during the day, like probably going to classes or doing something like that. Where for us, I mean, we're saying it's just somewhere that you can go that we won't touch. So we're providing you with a spot. We're providing you with restroom facilities, and that's it.
Violence, is there less violence or more violence in that area than you think there would be if these people were all isolated and in different parts of the city?
The types of violence reported in that area are probably at the safe zone itself, fighting and activities like that. The other types of violence that previously could be associated with this group of people are, you know, petty, probably crimes of opportunity, you know, like opening a car and taking out a wallet that's on the front seat or something like that. I can't tell you if it would have increased or decreased if this base load were not there.
Have you yourself visited this area much?
Yes.
Are you just sort of, I mean, is that part of your job, or just you know people there, or what?
It's probably in my capacity. I've done this in my business capacity. Probably going to investigate a complaint or to look at a particular issue that has arisen.
Is there a complaint process internally where folks can make complaints about the administration of the area?
No, because we have all the city workers who are on site. We have the security. So from time to time, the homeless individuals who are over there may complain about the actions of the security or may feel that they were asked to leave or fighting or something, when it's actually not them who actually initiated the fight, you know, things of that nature. We encourage them to speak to the foreman who's in charge of one of the workers over there.
This thing cost a year to run?
About $400,000.
And we're talking, what, about spaces for 160, but it grows to 240, say, on a...
No, you're talking pot, cannabis, restroom facilities, dumpster, pressure cleaning or sanitizing, perimeter cleaning, security, electricity, you know, those are the types of things that would go into.
And who voted, this was voted in 1992 or 93, or something like that? Was it done after a similar thing happened in Orlando or Miami? I guess you say it happened at subsequent, was this the Pottinger decision we're talking about?
That's correct.
And has there been any movement on that situation? I know there have been subsequent lawsuits and so forth. Is there still an active case in court around that issue?
I think there is, yes.
Do we know where it is, or I mean, are you guys appealing? What, I mean, are you involved in this?
No, we're not. I think what our attorneys were doing was to essentially watch the case, see what the outcome would be, and then at that point to determine what our next move would be.
The court that you didn't need safe zones. This zone would be disbanded.
There is a good possibility, yes.
And do you know where this is in the courts at the moment?
No, I do not.
Do you know actually when your zone was set up, more or less the month and the year?
Offhand, I don't know. I can find that out for you.
Oh. Us in the United States. So at the moment, however, there is no law in Fort Lauderdale for sleeping hold property, just in specific areas that have closing times.
Correct.
And that's been the case. How long have you been in town yourself?
I've been in town 6 years now.
So you, as far as you know, that's been the case?
That's correct.
Yeah. Thoughts on that?
The general thoughts are probably that the safe zone in its current form, it satisfies the legal restriction, but I don't think it's doing as much of a benefit to the community or to the individuals as we thought it would have. you are going to do something like this, for it to be effective, you need to have it more of a shelter, where people are monitored when they're trying to check in, check out, identify what issues or concerns are, and then trying to have them rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. Probably would be more productive, that way.
But in terms of it's providing places for people to sleep, it does do that job.
Correct.
And do people supply their own bedding and their sleeping bags? How do they?
Well, we have 160 cots, so anything in excess of that, I mean, and that's on a first-come, first-served basis. So, you know, if 180 people are there, the other many have to find their own bedding or sleeping arrangement.
And so you have, this is all sort of a large enclosed kind of tent area, or?
Right.
And then elsewhere people are kind of camped on the property just about.
Right.
And so current numbers are about 240.
Correct.
And this is a small fraction of the homeless population in the county. And what about in the city? How many homeless people do you estimate are in Fort Lauderdale?
Well, that's hard to tell, because people could be walking around and, you know, you're really looking at them would not know. We haven't done a survey to determine how many of the county population are in Fort Lauderdale. So I would not be able to answer that.
You don't have any kind of just vague ballpark idea, like is it 1,000 or 2,000 or...
No.
Nothing like that.
No.
But your county, you say, is 6,000 to 8,000?
Correct. A survey that was done maybe 6 years ago suggested that.
And is Lauderdale the largest city in the county?
It is the largest city, the county seat also.
And what's the population of the county? You know?
About 1,000,003.
And so Lauderdale is what, 165,000 you said?
Right, 160, yeah, about that.
So what might it be fair to assume that you have 10% of that population, or probably a bit more because you're an urban area?
Well, I wouldn't say that because you have a lot of urban areas along the coast of Broward County.
Uh-huh.
And for various reasons, you may have one municipality or one area serving as a greater draw for homeless than others. For example, we're a tourist destination. We've got a lot of activity on the beach, and homeless people may prefer to be kind of by themselves as opposed to in the limelight. So the fact that we have more traffic, more activity may be a deterrent as opposed to an attraction. So I wouldn't just go ahead and automatically assume that we're a proportionate fraction to our population.
I see. Although in terms of the camp itself, you regard it as more of a magnet than a deterrent?
Right, the camp itself, yes.
Has it grown past that 206, 240, or is it?
Sure. Very often the number has swelled to, you know, puts to 300 around the holiday times when in some instances places are closed, jobs, maybe people who would normally use day laborers from the camps, they're closed. So you may find also people are feeding from one office party to the other. People come by and may choose to provide food. So at those times, it has swelled, yes.
And so about a max of 300, you'd say?
Yes.
And do you take any measures to stop it from swelling further, or does that just assume a natural course?
One of the things that Legal Aid had taken us to court, and we had stipulated an agreement to limit the number to 240, because at that time that's what we were, based on our restroom facilities, able to accommodate. So we have recently, they have also reminded us of that a number of instances, and the health department has also reminded us that we have a capacity for no more than 240, so we have in the past month taken steps to start implementing that max cap.
And how do you do that?
At a certain time, maybe around 8 or 9, start doing counts, and if it's close enough to the 240, you know, like 245 or something, then we close the gate, and anyone wishing to come in after that time, we tell them that there's no additional room.
And has there been much overflow?
Thank you.
And that was city manager, staff person Horace McHugh in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, giving a description of the safe zone area in downtown near the city hall, which the city set up so that it could close its own parks at night and not get sued successfully in federal court after federal courts ruled that homeless people could not be arrested for sleeping if there were no safe zones. Now, we're hoping to have a second interview with folks from the Broward County Civil Rights Association to talk about what's going on with homeless people in this safe zone from the perspective of the homeless themselves or their advocates, and perhaps we'll be returning with that in our next edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, plus the conclusion of this interview, which we weren't quite able to finish tonight. That'll be on Sunday at 11 o'clock in the morning, when our show is a little longer, runs for 2.5 hours from 11 to 1:30. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. We have a quick announcement here from Becky Johnson, who's a homeless activist herself. And then we're going to go pretty directly into Uncle Dennis's show. Uncle Dennis is not going to be with us tonight from 8 to 10 as he usually is. He's got some loop tapes for us, Warrior Poets, the Warrior Poets Society, I should say, live in L.A., and also live in Tucson, but in this case taped and aired in Santa Cruz. But first, this announcement.
Hello, Free Radio listeners. This is Becky Johnson. Okay, I wanted to give you an update on some on the continuing saga of the Pelton Street property and former home of the Homeless Garden Project. We learned last night from two separate sources that the January 1997 Budget Committee, which had been posted on the agenda as having the matter of the distribution of funds from the Sky Park Trust, that was the only item posted on the agenda. This was a meeting where there no media was there, no members of the public were present, and it was at that meeting, according to the minutes, that the city council directed the city manager to establish a timeline to sell the Pelton Street property. When members of the public went and tried to find, to obtain a copy of the agenda for that budget committee meeting on January 97, and they couldn't, inquired about it, it could not be found. So there.
Yeah, I think the significance of that, as I understand it, is that the whole process of selling the Pelton Street property began in a meeting where it was essentially a sandbag deal, and the city council took action without informing the minority, Scott and Byers, who would have fought this successfully by bringing lots of people to the meeting, didn't inform the public and just set it on its way in a fashion that really has been quite consistent with what they've been doing in the months that followed, namely ignoring public protests, ignoring commissions, ignoring the signatures on a ballot initiative, ignoring every single speaker who was at City Council on Tuesday night.
But it is a requirement that the under the Brown Act that if City Council is going to make some sort of a decision or discuss an issue, the issue has to be posted in advance, times and places of the meetings made public, and apparently this was not done in this particular case. And by proceeding on it without proper procedure, it could be a Brown Act violation.
Right. Actually, the problem, of course, is to get an attorney to successfully pursue a lawsuit in time on that issue. And I don't know, probably the statute of limitations has run out a year later, but perhaps not. In any case, our time has run out. Bathrobe Spears Broadsides has to go. It's time for Uncle Dennis's show. I want to thank you for being with us. Give us a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, if you have any comments, thoughts, or additions for our next show. And join us on Sunday at 11 o'clock for another edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Coming up next, Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides with your host, Robert Norse. That's me. You're at 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Stay tuned with us for the next 2.5 hours for interviews up the wazoo on basic civil rights issues from around the state and around the country. We're going to be talking to Wiley Drake in Buena Park, California, Jennifer Wagoner in Santa Monica, California, John Caza in Salinas, and our own Richard Quigley here in Santa Cruz. Stay tuned. We're also hoping to have a live interview with a former free radio broadcaster from the early 90s, Tom Rebelli. Looks like a full day, so stay on board. Taking a little while for our equipment to warm up this morning, so hang in there with us, audience. We're going to come in with you just a second.
I'm serving time. I have a shop on the street in town where hungry folks walk up and down. Some have no homes, some sick from want. So I went, got some food from a restaurant. I took it to a central spot to feed the weary, something hot. The police came, took me away. Now for my awful deed, I've gotta pay. With 30 days in county jail, hold my calls, hold my mail, serving soup. That was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. They said I needed a permit to serve free food. It must be fit. So here I am, awaiting trial, while the hungry have to eat from the garbage pile. 30 days in the county jail. Hold my calls, hold my mail, serving soup. That was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. I face the judge and I made my plea. He looked away when he sentenced me. He said, we won't put you in that hole if you promise not to feed another living soul. I told that judge I could not say that crazy law I would obey. Nor pay no fine, or post no bail. Now I'm feeding folks inside the county jail. 30 days in the county jail. Hold my calls, hold my mail, serving soup. That was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Now Ollie North, he lied under oath, lied to the judge and the Congress both. He was running drugs guards for the Contra War. But they locked me up because I fed the poor. Our leader George, you know he might be right when he sees 1,000 points of light with a kindler gentler hearts like mine. But now there's just 999. 30 days in the county jail. Hold my calls, hold my mail. Serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. 30 days in the county jail. Hold my calls, hold my mail. Serving soup, that was my crime, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Well, serving time.
And that's singer Mark Levy, 999 points of light from George Bush's famous Leave It to Private Charities, Leave Your Compassion to Private Charities, 1,000 Points of Light. It's a song by singer Mark Levy on his album from the early 90s, Shiro's Heroes. Mark is a local folk singer here in the Santa Cruz area. He's up actually in, it's a bit beyond Felton, but you can actually get in touch with his company that puts out this kind of great political satire. He's done three or four of these tapes. We're going to be playing a few more of his songs. The song about the woman who was jailed for serving soup is actually about a local person, local merchant, Sandra Loringer, who was an antique dealer downtown before the earthquake, and she joined other activists at the town clock providing hot soup to homeless people at a time when there was no free meal program in town of that sort, and she was arrested for it along with dozens of others, eventually went to trial in the summer of 1989 and was convicted by a jury under pressure from Judge Robert Attuck, or the, you should say, the hard gavel of Robert Attuck. And there was also another person convicted of the similarly, his name was Brian Staley Flanagan. And I, of course, was convicted in San Francisco by a jury of serving free food. But it's all had a pretty good outcome. In Santa Cruz, Food Not Bombs now serves regularly on Thursdays and Wednesdays at the town clock, the same place where she was arrested. And that's at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Actually, I think it's either 4 or 5. It depends on the season. I think it's 4, but I may be wrong about that. If you want to find out and volunteer to help Food Not Bombs, you can give them a call at 425-3345, and they can give you more accurate times. And I do know it's at 1 o'clock on weekends, Saturdays and Sundays. So today, if you're hungry or you want to volunteer or you just need some extra bagels, they got plenty of bagels. Come on down to the town clock, 1 o'clock. You're not going to get arrested, and you're not going to get harassed by police, thanks to the work of people who did get arrested and did get harassed. And the same thing is true in San Francisco. They stopped the arrests the day after I went to jail. There was one more arrest, and then I served 27 days in jail in San Francisco in 1996 for serving free food. And after that, they have not arrested people specifically for the crime of serving free food since. And that actually kind of leads me into my next guest I have here live in the studio, Tom Reveille. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how are you, Bob?
Glad you made it. We have a kind of an isolated little studio here, kind of hard to reach. I wasn't sure you were going to make it, but I'm glad you're here. Tom, you're an old timer in free radio. You had a station way back when in Venice, California, that got severely harassed. In fact, it got wiped out by FCC, right?
Right, straight busted, 1991. That's right.
And what was the name of that station?
Radio Free Venice.
And how long did that station have on the air before it was closed down?
About 7 months. From the 13th of April, from Jefferson's birthday, to sometime in November. The 13th of November. From the 11th of April, maybe. I think Jefferson's birthday was the 11th to the 13th of November.
And were you, was this pretty much, you were one of the many commentators on the station, or was it your station? How was it run? Was it a collective? What was the story?
Well, it started with my notion. I mean, it played out of my home at the time. There was a sort of a patio on the outside. And it was basically, I was trying to gall, it was a constitutional radio station in the sense that when we went on the air, I wrote letters. I wrote a broadcaster's declaration of Ninth Amendment rights, and also wrote letters to the FCC and to the judges.
And the Ninth Amendment, for those who don't know, is of course the amendment that reserves all rights not specifically delegated to the federal government, to the people, or to the state.
The Ninth Amendment is that's a kind of a conflation of the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. What you just said, the Ninth Amendment says that all rights not specifically enumerated, that in other words, that the rights specifically enumerated were not in detriment of or in deny. Golly, why can't I remember the exact wording?
But the thing is that the
other rights retained by the people.
Right, all rights are retained by the people, even those that don't happen to be itemized in the actual federal constitution.
Exactly, articulated and so on.
Well, I'm sorry, I was interrupting. You were saying that you were a constitutional station.
That we were a constitutional station in the sense that we never made a secret of where we were, that we told them exactly we were going to start before we started broadcast. We were going to broadcast. It was our right, and if they wanted to do something about it, you know, the thing. In fact, I expected them to do something about it, and I expected that we'd have a fair fight in court, and then we'd win, because constitutionally, not only constitutionally, but as I later learned, also in terms of the law, their law, the FCC law, we are completely constitutional to be intrastate power station. And so I thought we'd win. And apparently they thought we'd win too, because the only way that they could find to fight me after seven months, I had absolutely nothing but my typewriter and my my long tongue to protect them. After that, they just busted me. They just walked in and took everything and basically dared me to do anything about it. Then brought charges against me.
Before we go into that, I want to hear more about that. What gave you the idea of starting the station? Had you been inspired by some previous efforts?
Well, it was basically the idea was that, you know, we've got this huge problem that we live in a quasi-fascist state. They're fast becoming, I think, the worst kind of fascism. And so what do you do? I mean, what activity isn't vitiated by the fact that we're under capitalism in a money, you know, in a money, can I say, a state that's ruled by the money power and which is not constitutional in any way. And what I decided was that this is the only war in which one side gets all of its intelligence from the other side, and that we could not possibly win while that was the case. And so that we had to have a medium whereby we could tell each other the truth on the air, and that medium had to be radio. Because it was the only one. Do you know, because you're involved in this radio, but how little money it takes. For less than $1,000, you can go on the air with a station which it has a community, you know, for a small or medium-sized community, which is a community radio station. You can put a 10-watt transmitter on the air, as Cantaco and the Black Rose and Fresno and so on, and Bana Cantaco, who are among the forefathers of this movement.
Tell us a little bit about that. Who are the forebears of our movement? Who are the women and men who started this?
Well, probably the one that's gotten the most attention, and rightfully so, is the man Mbana Kantako, is his name. I don't know whether he's not indigenous. He's in Adrian, Michigan. That's where he is. And he started, he's now legally blind, he was beaten up by cops and so on, but he started it as a part of a ghetto project to help people in the project, to help them. I think it started as part of a tenants' rights organization and so on, that he started this small radio station. And then from there, he has simply kept it on the air by sheer guts, and he's been shot at. He's been, you know, they tried to kill him through the window of his, shooting bullets that they say were stray bullets through the, but he cuts into police. They have ways of monitoring what the police are saying to each other and so on. So you can imagine what kind of a problem he presents for the law enforcement, the quote law enforcement. People in Adrian.
How long ago was this, Tom? And is this station still on the air? Do you know?
Oh yes, he's definitely on the air. Oh yeah, he's this was and he started back in the mid '80s or maybe the early '80s. So he's been going for a long time, and he's gotten a lot of attention internationally and so on.
What specifically made you decide in 1991 to start a radio station? Had you tried another project and decided that didn't work, so radio was the best way to proceed? Had you read an article about this man? Had you suddenly ran into him in a supermarket? What happened?
No, I got an offer, actually. I had lived in Venice in 1987. I'd met a number of people who called themselves activists, who were liberals and so on. And in 1991, I got an agent. To sort of help run a cafe. He had sort of lucked into the management of a cafe on the boardwalk.